Today is Tuesday, June 25th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a group of attorneys checking on immigrant children find them living in unhealthy, unsanitary conditions.
We couldn't believe what we were seeing. They were sick, they were coughing, they had runny noses, they were filthy dirty, and they immediately started to describe the level of hunger that they were experiencing.
President Trump announces even more sanctions in response to Iran's downing of a U.S. drone. Also ahead, a never-before-heard song by Prince that helped an all-girl group rise to stardom. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. President Donald Trump targeted Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei and other top Iranian officials with sanctions Monday, taking a dramatic, unprecedented step to increase pressure on Iran after downing an unarmed American drone. And with tensions running high between the two countries, Trump signed an executive order imposing the sanctions.
Today's action follows a series of aggressive behaviors by the Iranian regime in recent weeks, including shooting down of U.S. drones. You shot down the drone. I guess everyone saw that one, and many other things. They've done many other things aside from the individual drone. You saw the tankers, and we know of other things that were done also, which were not good and not appropriate. The supreme leader of Iran is one who ultimately is responsible for the hostile conduct of the regime. He's respected within his country. His office oversees the regime's most brutal instruments, including the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. Sanctions imposed through the executive order that I'm about to sign will deny the supreme leader and the supreme leader's office and those closely affiliated with him and the office access to key financial resources and support. The assets of Ayatollah Khamenei and his office will not be spared from the sanctions. These measures represent a strong and proportionate response to Iran's increasingly provocative actions. We will continue to increase pressure on Tehran until the regime abandons its dangerous activities and aspirations, including the pursuit of nuclear weapons, increased enrichment of uranium, development of ballistic missiles, engagement in and support for terrorism, fueling of foreign conflicts, and belligerent acts directed against the United States and its allies.
Well, Trump said the sanctions will deny the supreme leader and the leader's office and those close to him access to key financial resources and support. John Blaxland, professor of international security and intelligence studies at the Australian National University, joins us. What do you make of what has been happening here?
It's very interesting what's happening. It looks like President Trump is seeking to get more concessions from Iran, and if not just get concessions on the nuclear program, actually initiate or facilitate regime change, and that is something that is likely to generate considerable backlash. I think there's an interesting parallel here with the game that President Trump has been playing with Kim Jong-un as well, and which would run counter to the previous argument if it's true. But this is one of the things that's so much conjecture. What is President Trump doing and why is he doing it? But I think there is a parallel to what's happened with the playbook that's been played with Kim Jong-un of ratcheting up pressure and then providing a backdoor, an opportunity for some kind of face-saving conciliatory gesture. But it's a gesture that's beyond Kim Jong-un in North Korea and beyond the Iranian regime in Tehran, simply because what they're asking for is an existential threat to the regime and something that they're not prepared to tolerate. So essentially, being a cornered animal, the Iranians will most likely continue lashing out. They're in a very difficult position. They don't feel they can compromise much further than they have already. Their economic circumstances are becoming very, very difficult. The additional sanctions will undoubtedly pinch. And the Iranians have up their sleeve a capability with the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps and the Quds Force, the ability to strike at U.S. and allied forces in Afghanistan, in Iraq and Syria, which means that any additional pressure from the United States and its allies needs to take into consideration the potential backlash will quickly arise.
Right. We had this Iran nuclear agreement.
Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action.
All indications, according to the UN, Iran was complying. But President Trump said it was a terrible deal, the worst deal he'd ever seen, and pulled the United States out of it. There were those that warned him that it would just create more problems. Do you think that that did contribute to all of this?
Look, the approach of the Trump administration to the JCPOA, Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, is a bit like the effect that the Trump administration's approach to the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal of a couple of years ago. It has undermined Western solidarity with the United States, and it has pushed the United States onto a trajectory that likely will result in consequences that are inimical to America's interests, let alone the interests of its allies. The JCPOA was widely acknowledged as the best of a bad set of options. No one realistically was putting forward something other than the prospect of a major war that would have at all contained the Iranian impulse for nuclearization. And by abandoning the JCPOA, the United States has made it very difficult for its allies to hold fast with the United States. And it has made it easier for the Iranians to look for some kind of retaliatory action. And it has also undermined, I believe, the prospect of a reformist, more democratic, more Western-oriented government emerging from Iran, simply because anybody looking, being seen to be sympathetic to the Trump administration's position is now vulnerable to being seen as non-patriotic and undermining of Iran's fundamental interests. So on one level, the Trump administration's plans had an altruistic intention. The consequences of inadequately thought-through strategy have the potential to be catastrophic.
How dangerous of a situation do you think we are approaching here?
It's hard to say. The future is never clear, but there are internal mechanisms both in Iran and in the United States and amongst the United States' allies that would preclude the prospect of a rapid escalation. Let's be clear. It's an odious regime. The actions of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps in Iraq, in Syria, against U.S. and allied forces over the last decade and a half has been disgraceful and absolutely reprehensible. The question now, though, is how do you best get your desired end state? And if your desired end state is a non-nuclear Iran or a Iran that is more sympathetic to the West, it's a high-stakes crash-through-or-crash approach that on one level looks like it might work, but on another likely will result in a lashing out that could be very, very dangerous.
And do you also see what's happening having farther-reaching potential consequences beyond the United States and Iran?
It's very interesting to think about the broader dynamics. This isn't just about Iran and the United States. Saudi Arabia has a stake. Saudi Arabia has been a long adversary of Iran and is eager to push the United States to get Iran to be further hobbled and its influence, particularly in Syria and Lebanon, to be reduced. There's an interesting coalition that has emerged between Saudi Arabia, the United States and Israel aimed at containing and pushing back the influence of Iran, particularly in Syria, but also in Iraq. The United States' relationship with Russia is also part of the equation. So this is more than just a simple Iran-US clash. The implications are broader, they're regional and beyond.
All right, that's John Blaxland, Professor of International Security and Intelligence Studies at the Australian National University. We thank you for being with us. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. A North Dakota prairie is home to one of America's first mosques. An unruly private life disrupts Boris Johnson's bid to lead Britain. The Taliban warns Afghan media against airing anti-insurgency ads. Local Cambodian patrols seek to end illegal logging. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. U.S. Customs and Border Protection has removed most of the children from a remote Border Patrol station in Texas, following reports that more than 300 kids detained there were living in unhealthy and unsanitary conditions with inadequate food, water, and sanitation. Warren Binford is a children's rights advocate and lawyer and one of the attorneys in a group that witnessed the conditions firsthand recently and brought the situation to light.
When we got there on Monday morning, we were immediately given a roster showing that there were over 350 children at this facility. And then when we scanned the roster, we were taken aback by the number of very young children at this facility. There were over 100 young children who were being kept there. And so we immediately asked the guards to start to bring us the youngest children and also the children who had been there the longest. We also saw that there were about a half a dozen child mothers and their infants. And so we asked the guards to also bring us those children. When the children walked into the conference room, we couldn't believe what we were seeing. They were sick. They were coughing. They had runny noses. They were filthy, dirty. And they immediately started to describe the level of hunger that they were experiencing. They told us that they were being fed nothing but the same meals three times a day, and they weren't really meals. These are frankenfood. These are highly processed chemical foods. In the morning, they are given instant oatmeal, a packet of Kool-Aid, and a cookie. For lunch, they are given instant soup, a cookie, and another packet of Kool-Aid. And then for dinner, they're given a frozen burrito in a plastic wrapper, similar to what you would see at a gas station. And some of the children complained that the burritos were often not thoroughly cooked. And then they also, at that point, are given another cookie and a Kool-Aid. Young children are being given this meal. Child mothers are being given this meal. And so the children, on a routine basis, said that they were hungry. On top of that, the children started to describe rooms in which there were 25, 50, 100 children. One boy said that when he first arrived there, there were over 300 children in a room. When we talked to the Border Patrol officers who are running this facility, they reported to us that the facility had recently undergone an expansion, but we couldn't figure out where that expansion was. So after that first day of interviewing, we drove around the facility and we saw a metal warehouse with no walls. And we couldn't believe that that possibly could be the expansion. But when we talked to the Border Patrol officers the next day and started to talk to the children about where they were being kept, we found out that, in fact, that one warehouse was allegedly what had given them an additional capacity of 500 additional children. So then what happened was, as we started to talk about the children, we asked them, who is taking care of you? And we found out that, in fact, virtually no one is taking care of these children directly, that they are locked up in these cells 24 hours a day. There are open toilets in many of these cells. There's no soap, no way to wash their hands. They're being fed in these cells, the processed instant foods that I described for you earlier. And many of them are being forced to sleep on concrete because of a shortage of beds and mats and sleeping space. Children describe sleeping on concrete floors. They describe sleeping on cement blocks. Not just the older children, but we heard of infants, toddlers, preschoolers, school-aged children who were having to sleep on the floor. To make things worse, as we were trying to call in the youngest children, because we were especially concerned about the vulnerabilities of certain elements of this population, we found out that there were a number of children that they could not bring to us because they were so sick. And so we started to count the number of children who apparently were sick at this facility and had been quarantined. And we estimated that at least 15 children that we knew about were in quarantine during the time that we were there. And when we finally got access to these children by telephone, we learned about the conditions in these quarantine facilities, which were just horrendous. These very sick children with high fevers are being put on the floor, on mats, largely unsupervised, locked up together for days at a time. They're being brought the same foods that are being fed to everybody else at the facility, despite the fact that they're very sick. They also have someone who is coming there twice a day to check their fever and to give them any medications that are needed. But there's nobody really caring for these children in the quarantine areas, despite their severe illness. Now, keep in mind that many of the children who have died in these Border Patrol facilities in recent months died from influenza, which is very, very rare in a developed country like the United States. But as you can see, these are not conditions that you would expect to see in the United States.
The Trump administration made a formal policy of zero tolerance in 2018 to detain any and all migrants who crossed the border without authorization, leading to adults and children being held in separate facilities. The U.S. Customs and Border Patrol agency is under scrutiny over several deaths of children in its custody since late last year. The battle for the Democratic Party's 2020 presidential nomination kicks into high gear this week with the first of what will be monthly debates among the candidates leading up to the first caucus and primary votes early next year. The first debates will be held over two nights, this Wednesday and Thursday, and will feature 10 different contenders each night, vying for the right to take on President Trump in November of 2020. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has a preview.
It may be the most crowded Democratic field of all time, led for now by former Vice President Joe Biden. Biden's argument is that he is the strongest candidate to take on President Donald Trump next year.
I hope to be your nominee. I'm going to work as hard as I can to get your support. But here's the deal. Whomever the Democratic nominee is, we have to stay together and elect a Democrat president of the United States of America.
In recent days, Biden has come under attack for defending his long-ago work with segregationists in the Senate, potentially opening up a new vulnerability. Trailing Biden in the polls is Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, who has been surging of late.
This is what democracy is all about. It's about being out, being with people, and having a chance to talk about our vision for America. You know, it's not enough just to say not Donald Trump.
Pete Buttigieg, the previously little-known mayor of South Bend, Indiana, and California Senator Kamala Harris round out the top tier. A large group of other Democratic contenders continues to lag behind, hoping to build momentum with a strong debate performance. The debates mark a turning point in the campaign, says analyst Kyle Condon.
I really think the debates have become sort of the main event almost of the primary season, particularly because you've got all these candidates going across the country, appearing at some of the key primary states and really all across the country. But we don't actually have any voting to go on here until early February of next year.
Contenders will be under pressure to make a quick impression, says expert Larry Sabato.
You're going to have four, five, six candidates who find just the right soundbite, who find just the right attack on one another or on President Trump to get in that highlights reel. They will be the ones potentially to gain from the debates. The others may lose ground and may lose donors.
President Trump is likely to be the focal point of attack in the Democratic debates, and he is already eager to take on the Democratic field.
Our radical Democrat opponents are driven by hatred, prejudice, and rage. They want to destroy you, and they want to destroy our country as we know it. Not acceptable. It's not going to happen.
Trump's debate performances in 2016 helped to propel him to the Republican Party nomination. Many Democrats will be looking for what experts call a breakthrough moment, including Andra Gillespie.
You know, if their top tier candidate could help sustain their front runner status, or if they're somewhere in the middle could actually help forge a type of, you know, breakthrough moment that might get them extra attention.
Elizabeth Warren is the top contender in the first debate on Wednesday. Biden, Sanders, Buttigieg, and Harris will all be on stage for the second night of debate on Thursday. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Scientists are conducting an experiment to test whether a fungus genetically engineered to produce a toxin found in spider venom can provide a breakthrough in the worldwide fight against malaria. VOA's Kevin Enix reports.
According to the Severe Malaria Observatory, the mosquito-borne disease is the leading cause of child mortality in the African nation of Burkina Faso. It's a loss no parent should have to suffer.
Losing a child was really painful for me, or for any parent for that matter. So if we can find a solution against this disease which killed my child, other people we will thank God. They should do everything to eradicate this disease. They should help us. We have hope and we are happy with how far the project has gone.
More than half of the world's population is at risk of contracting the disease, but it's a unique problem in Africa. And that's where University of Maryland researchers are testing a fungus that kills mosquitoes on contact.
We took a gene from a spider, and we put that spider gene, which encodes an insect-selective toxin, we put that gene into the fungus under the control of a promoter, and the promoter is the on-off switch of a gene. So under the control of this promoter, which only turns on in insect blood.
The fungus works quickly and effectively on malaria-carrying mosquitoes the moment it comes in contact with the insects.
Out of the box, if they land anywhere on the outside of a mosquito, they'll recognize that they're on a mosquito and they'll burrow their way into the mosquito.
In tests, once the fungus was introduced into a mosquito population, the mosquitoes were gone in a month. But success in the lab doesn't mean success in the field. So the team is testing their mosquito-killing fungus in Burkina Faso with the help of researchers there. Using raw meat, the team attracts mosquitoes into these test rooms. Once inside, they rest on a black cloth that has been treated with the fungus. The results are swift.
Well, basically, within two generations, we've killed 99% of the mosquitoes. So we caused the mosquito population to collapse.
The researchers say that the dramatic results of their test and using their treatment along with insecticides could have a big impact on fighting malaria and also could be adapted to fight other diseases like Zika or dengue.
That's Kevin Enix reporting. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, 4 years ago on June 26, 2015, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that same-sex couples have the right to marry, a right guaranteed by the Constitution's equal protection clauses. The landmark ruling accelerated a growing public acceptance of LGBTQ marriage, which includes lesbian, gay, and other diverse sexual orientations. But as VOA's Brian Patton reports, while opposition to same-sex marriage is declining, it is still a strong political force in the country.
Some friends and family members expected something out of the ordinary when Eddie Bogart and Robert Lee were married 2 years ago in Newcastle, Pennsylvania.
We had a lot of people expecting or, you know, being interested or wanted to know what our wedding would be like.
And today I promise to love you unconditionally.
But what they witnessed was a traditional and legally binding ceremony that publicly validated their loving relationship and commitment.
It puts us equal to everybody else, I think, you know. And to me, a marriage is a marriage, whether it's a gay marriage or a straight marriage.
4 years ago, the U.S. Supreme Court legalized same-sex marriage in a ruling that helped advance lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender rights in America. Today, 60% of Americans support same-sex marriage compared to 60% who opposed it 15 years ago, according to the Pew Research Center. And 29 countries have also legalized same-sex marriage, with Taiwan this year becoming the first country in Asia to permit gay and lesbian couples to marry. While opposition to same-sex marriage in the U.S. may be in decline, it is still a powerful force in politics. Christian groups have used this issue to mobilize support, even among some religious Democrats, for President Trump, who has embraced conservative values.
I think this is a problem for the Democratic Party, that as they become increasingly radical, tied to increasingly radical social policies, it's going to be harder and harder for some of their historical supporters to continue to support them.
But the strong support for Democratic presidential contender Pete Buttigieg may undermine that argument. The South Bend, Indiana mayor, who is gay and married to another man, is one of a rising number of LGBT politicians who advocates say have benefited from being open about their sexuality.
Voters feel like if they're being honest and open about who they are in something like, you know, their sexuality, that means they're going to be open and honest across the board with voters.
Politics aside, same-sex relationships in the U.S. have become increasingly part of the diverse fabric of America, with Bobby and Eddie breaking down bias in their community by being just another married couple. Brian Patton, VOA News, Newcastle, Pennsylvania.
A utility company that supplies electricity in the Washington, D.C. area has given away 1,000 free trees to residential customers with the goal of saving energy. Pepco is one of dozens of companies in America working with the nonprofit Arbor Day Foundation on the plan. And while the main goal is to conserve energy, officials say the trees benefit homeowners and neighborhoods in other ways, too. Faiza El-Masri reports from Hyattsville, Maryland, in this report that's narrated by Faith Lapidus.
Gardening is Anka Meyer's favorite hobby, and she loves to plant trees in her yard.
Right now they bloom, and they will be green, and then they have fall colors, so they change throughout the year, which is really nice. I mean, trees generate happiness.
Trees also improve air quality and reduce the effect of summer heat.
Trees make a huge difference in the climate around your house and also energy savings if they shade from the south side and the west side especially. What we notice is when we come in from the streets into our area, the temperature actually drops by several degrees, probably 5 to 10 degrees Fahrenheit because of the tree cover.
This is the second year Meyer is taking part in a program that gives her trees. Last year she got a red maple. Now she's getting ready to plant the dogwood she received through the Energy Saving Trees program, sponsored by the local utility company Pepco and the nonprofit Arbor Day Foundation.
They are native to this region, so they don't grow in the cold, and it's really a beautiful tree. Getting a tree is actually, it's an investment, especially if you get trees that are disease resistant.
By serving as a windbreak in the winter and providing shade in the summer, the Arbor Day Foundation's Kristen Boske says trees can help homeowners conserve energy, save money, and more.
Providing a tree to homeowners can increase a property value by up to 18%.
Boske says the Arbor Day Foundation has partnered with Pepco since 2011 to help its customers reduce energy costs, as well as bring an environmental outlook to the communities they serve. And she expects the initiative to grow.
The Arbor Day Foundation just launched an initiative along with our partners called the Time for Trees Initiative. Through that initiative, we will be planting 100 million trees and inspiring 5 million tree planters around the globe to bring trees to communities, to forests, to everywhere that trees are needed.
According to Pepco spokesperson Christina Harper, the Energy Saving Trees program has grown more popular over the last 8 years.
About 10,500 homeowners have benefited from this important partnership, and we've seen that over 17,000 trees have been planted. A properly planted tree can save homeowners about 15 to 30% on their energy bills.
Tree lover Anka Meyer encourages others to plant trees.
Try to find out which trees are native in your area. Don't plant anything that is not adapted to it. Look where you plant. Don't plant it too close to the house.
That's the impact the program organizers hope to have, inspiring more people around the globe to plant trees. For writer Faiza El-Masri in Hyattsville, Maryland, Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
A new release of never-before-heard songs by the late artist known as Prince out, and it's a compilation of previously unheard songs that he wrote for other artists who became famous because of his writing and lyrics. He didn't just provide them the song, he apparently discovered them too, the Bangles, in the early days of performing. He wrote the song specifically for their band, an all-female group that got their breakthrough thanks to the song Manic Monday. It went on to perform numerous other hits, including Walk Like an Egyptian and Eternal Flame. These are the days when you wish your bed was already made. It's just another manic Monday. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today, but we thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day. It's just another manic Monday. Have to catch an early train. Still couldn't make it in time. 'Cause it takes me so long just to figure out what I'm gonna wear. Blame it on the train, but the boss is already
This is VOA News.